some of my songs I have casually mentioned the fact that I like to drink beer. This little song is more to the point. Roll out the barrel and lend me your ears. I like beer. It makes me a jolly good fellow. I like beer. It helps me unwind, and sometimes it makes me feel mellow.
Makes him feel mellow.
Welcome to Beer Sessions.
Whiskey's
Radio.
Too
Radio.
Champagne.
You guys hear me out there? It's Tuesday, January 11th, 2011. And we're here at Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carbone from Jimmy's Number 43, joined with my co-host, Ray Dieter from TBA. Ray, how are you? Did you have a good weekend?
No, I had a great weekend. We just had our fourth annual Cask Festival. By annual, I mean fourth in 1 year. It was widely successful. It was packed. And we had a great time. We had some incredible beer there. Alex Hall curated the whole event and worked his butt off. And it was just a great, great event.
What was your favorite cask?
Oh, boy. Geez. You know, this is going to sound really pedestrian and sad, but on Sunday we ran out of everything except for one cask of Fuller's ESB that we brought up. And it was really, really old. And we got it from our distributor, who I won't mention, but it was a November. So used by November, blah, blah, blah. And it was January, blah,
horrible.
Blah, blah. It was delicious.
It's still your favorite beer then after all these years?
I'm still rocking the Fuller's ESB, man.
We love that. And we'll give a shout out to our sponsor, GreatBrewers.com. It's where the beer industry meets the larger beer community. See the latest updates for Beer Cloud, a mobile app to help you locate your favorite beers. GreatBrewers.com, it's all about the brewers. We're also supported by the people at the Good Beer Seal, an association of 27 New York City beer bars that serve, promote, and support good beer, GoodBeerSeal.com. We've got some special guests tonight on Beer Sessions Radio. One of them is Wendy Littlefield from Van Berg and DeWolf, someone who I only just met today. And I think, Ray, you've known Wendy for a few years, haven't you?
About 16, 17, I believe.
Yeah. What was your first impression of Wendy when you met her years ago?
Well, it was all about the beer. And Wendy's lovely, beautiful woman, and had great beers. And we didn't see each other that many times over the years. She'd pop into the bar. I'd see her at an event here and there. But her impact on the imported beers in the States has been amazing.
Well, she gave it. I had an impact from her last night. I was drinking one of their beers, the DuPont Monette.
Oh, yeah.
The Brune, and I just couldn't stop drinking it. It was like my love affair with Belgian beer is back, guys. Forget the Americans. Now I'm back to Belgium. And just in time for Wendy. Wendy, how are you?
I'm great. Great to be here on the eve of the snowstorm.
Yes. So apparently 30 years ago, Belgian beer was very different, and you guys had a big role in changing American perception of Belgian beer, didn't you?
Well, that remains to be seen, but I think we've had a little role to play, and I actually want to give a thanks to Ray, because in truth, my husband and I started importing beer 30 years ago. We first brought in Duvel in 1982, but it was because of places like DBA that the market developed, because you had to have establishments that allowed people to educate themselves and find what they like. So Ray was one of the great pioneers in this country to establish an outpost for people to have good beers. True. And we didn't, it's true, when he says we didn't see each other very often, Don and I moved to a small town in upstate New York, to Cooperstown, around 1990. So we operated nationally, but from a very remote place. And we were lucky to be able to do that. But
yeah. Well, you guys brought in such great beers. I mean, obviously, the DuPont collection of beers. I've actually been out to the brewery once or twice. And it still remains one of the best beers in the world. It really is. And
DuPont?
When are you going to bring in the Pilsner?
This year.
Really? It's going to come in?
Yeah. Actually, our collection of... We'll have 30 beers in our portfolio this year, 10 of them from DuPont.
What else do you bring in, Wendy?
Well, from brewery-based, we work with Dubuisson, the makers of Scaldis. We work with Witkap, which is a slag molder brewery. We work with DuPont. We're working with a young brewery close to the Dutch border, the Skelt Brewery, and we've created a beer called Hoprider, which I brought to taste today. It's a beer Don says is imported from 1982 because it's his rendition of what he remembers beers tasting like when he was a graduate student in Belgium. And then we're also working with De Troc on, I think, a really spectacular product called Lambrucha, which is a combination of lambic and kombucha.
Wow.
So
that's interesting. I love kombucha.
Yeah, and then we also just brought in vintage Decam, the old lambic, which I brought today. Have you had that yet, Ray?
No, I haven't.
That is only 220 cases, and it was, we bought it 3 years ago, but we only took delivery of it about 2 months ago.
Wow, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, it's really great. And Carol Godot, who's the blender of Decam, is also the brewer at Whitkep.
Okay. Wendy, the question I've been dying to ask you. Wendy's great. She called me a couple months ago. We had a nice talk about it. First question is, how many breweries are there in Belgium?
There are about 130 now.
Now, she called me out because I had said that there were 4,000 breweries in Belgium.
Small now, correction.
I'm wrong, but why would I have thought that?
Oh, how many beers are there?
Maybe it was beers.
Yeah. I mean, at the turn of the century, there were 1,200, and when we began importing, there were between 300 and 400. So there's been a tremendous consolidation. Meanwhile, a proliferation of brands, but a lot of the brands that you see are sometimes label beers. They're the same beer created for seven different villages, same beer inside, different label on the outside.
And there's a lot of contract brewing going on, too. There's one brewery making a lot of different things that are coming out. Like for example, Mortgat makes a bunch of different things.
Yeah, I wouldn't put Mortgat in the category of the contract brewers, per se, but there are breweries that are hardly more than laboratories, mm-hmm. doing tons of beers. And that's one of the manifestos for the future for us, is that, you know, there are really three platforms that we're operating on this point. We having imported what we thought was the best example of every indigenous style from Belgium, having built Brewery Omegang, and then having begun to work with a sort of hand-holding with young brewers in Belgium, in addition to championing the great independence, we really stand against contract brewing. We also stand against phony limited edition beers. I'm saying this in a sort of harsh way, but... I guess I'm old enough to do it at this point, because I think there's a danger when you have these really fantastic traditional brewers that have incredible investments in real estate and people and tradition and ingredients. We need to tell people about those things, because there's the fact that Belgium has become known for great beer has not escaped the notice of people who are commercializers of things. And there are many, many beers out there that are not as good as the great beers in Belgium, but most people don't know that. They just buy it because they think it's Belgian. And it actually represents a real threat to the great independent brewers, because the people who are doing contract brews don't have the investment in the market. They just are riding on the coattails. So I know everybody in this room cares about those things and helps to make those stories apparent to their clients. But there's probably 95% of craft brewers are not that vigilant.
There's a lot of breweries out there, not breweries, beers out there that come from Belgium and have that Belgian kind of hipness or whatever. But I'm aware of the ones that aren't exactly brewed by a real human being. It's not somebody's vision. You know, it's a process. It's a marketing strategy more than it is an actual vision or a work of art, if you will.
Well, that's another thing that's important. Tony, who's sitting to my right, and I've known Tony probably over 20 years.
Oh, down.
Tony Forter from Errol Street is bringing a group of people to Belgium. And all it takes is to go and to see a handful of breweries, and you will know very readily that which is authentic, artisanal, run by people who, you know, care about their community versus something that is
factory brews.
Yeah.
And then you know, I've been over there too a bunch of times, and you know, there's people brewing in their garage. There's people brewing it like in, you know, like for example, like Cantillon, they're brewing in this like in the middle of Brussels in this like filthy facility, which is great, you know, and their beer is wonderful. And you got to just keep those people going, because there's passion and there's great ingenuity.
Absolutely.
Wendy, what beer are we drinking right now? The Hop Rooter?
Who opened? Why did we open? Hop Rooter.
Tell us about this beer.
Okay. So this is a product of the Skelt Brewery, which, as I said, is a small independent brewery representative of sort of the new wave of young brewers in Belgium, close to the Dutch border. Don went to visit with them. I always give Don the credit because I'm like Miss Sustainability and champion of my husband's palate. I am not as nearly the beer geek that he is. But he went to visit Skelt on the recommendation of some people 2 years ago. And he liked their beers, but he didn't think they were distinctive or different enough to really make it in the market here. But he felt they were talented. So he asked them to create a beer that what Don says is it's imported from 1982. It's how he remembers the sort of slightly wild, raucous, yeasty, malty beers of Belgium, the strong golden ales, tasting in the day. But admittedly, he wanted a little more hop kick. So this beer was created transatlantically with Hoost sending samples of various trials to us in Chicago, and we taste them in the kitchen and say, it was like, you know, mama bear, papa bear, baby bear. This one's just right. So it was kind of universally agreed that one of their iterations was really terrific, and that became Hop Rooter. And Hop Rooter means hop rider, and the town of Turnhout, which is very near where the brewery is, was the center of the playing card industry, so you can sort of see a little bit of the
it's a beautiful label.
Imagery. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, we'd never heard of the beer, and your salesman, Ben Woods here, great guy. And we'll get to hear from him later. Ben Wood.
Ben's putting us back on the map in New York.
Yeah, and we did at Jimmy's 43, we did a night, we opened a lot of our large bottles, and everyone thought Hop Rooter was like one of the most interesting bottles.
Isn't it a really great balance of...
It's great. It's unfiltered.
Yes.
Unfiltered, and it's kind of a golden color.
Mm-hmm.
And let's get Tony Forder. If you don't know him, you should. He's editor of Ale Street News. He's a legend. We love him. Tony, you've been covering beer for how many years?
Yeah, hi, beer friends. Well, we started the Ale Street News in 92, and we took our first tour to Belgium in 96. We'd done one other tour before that to the Great British Beer Festival. And it's like, you know, we were discovering all these great beers domestically. The craft brewing revolution was just, you know, just... It's like a train in a station. The wheels were just starting to spin. I hadn't really got the momentum to pull out of the station yet, but a lot was going on. And then you come to this door that says Belgian beer, and we opened that door, and it was like we're still free-falling into the Belgian beers and everything. And the first tour we took to Belgium, 96, we started working with the tour operator, Greg Dennis of Short Hills Tours, who we still work with. And we only had 12 people sign up. And he said, well, there's not enough people for me to go, so you guys are on your own. And he made the arrangements. But we were just a bunch of rookies in Belgium. We're all in it together. And, you know, we had a great time.
All right.
It's funny. I would run into you all the time in Belgium at different festivals. I think I see Tony more in Belgium and in England than I see you actually in New York or New Jersey.
Yeah, and it's become crazy now. We always go. This is our 12th year that we do our tour to Beer Paradise in Belgium the first week in March, because that's when the Zethos Festival is, which is a great artisanal collection of brewers in Belgium in the town of St. Nicholas. And it's amazing. It's become Beer Week Belgium. They don't call it Beer Week like we have here everywhere now. But there are people there just touring the country. Last year, for example, there were four different buses. There were our bus. There was a bus of people that, mostly from the San Diego area. There was an Italian bus. There was a British bus. And we kept crisscrossing, seeing each other in different places. In Belgium.
What is that festival, the Lambic festival that's south of Brussels?
Palliators.
Right.
Yeah, we were there last year. That is crazy. We tasted 29 vintage Lambics in one sitting.
It's ridiculous. I
mean, we also go to the Night of Great Thirst, which is every 2 years.
Yeah.
That's what I'm speaking of.
Okay, yeah. It's always freezing cold and raining and
muddy.
But they have a lot of the Lambic producers there for one night at the... at this little bar in the town of, escapes me right now, but the name of the bar is In Defense of Great Thirst, if
right.
you translate it.
Right.
And it's it was parents were going to give the place up, and the two sons who have other jobs decided to take it on, and they do this collection of great Lambic beers every
so
2 years.
We're going to take Wendy and make her a tour guide for the Ale Street News tour of Belgium. Wendy,
okay,
top five places to hired. Go in Belgium. Where should I go?
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, just remember that any little town pretty much has its own brewery, and that's one of the pleasures. That's how we got turned on to Belgian beers. Everywhere we went, we found something good to drink. So can I do this from a cultural rather than a beer standpoint?
Of course. It's your answer.
So I think you want to go to Brussels. And in Brussels, you should go see the new Magritte collection, which is in the Royal Museum.
It's okay. We do take some time off for beer.
Well, you can do the beer commentary. And then I think I would go to A la Fleur au Papier Doré, which is a cafe, one of the most beautiful cafes in Brussels. Not the biggest beer list, but the most atmospheric cafe that I know. And then you can go on the Grand Place and have a beer and go to A la Bécasse.
The Grand Place at night is wonderful.
So, Tony, which beer would you drink in Brussels? She's culture, your beer.
I mean, it's just, there's so many to choose from everywhere. There's a great new bar, the Moda Lambic. They used to have a place on the edge of town. Now they have a place pretty near the Grand Place. And they're, what's different about it is they have like 30 taps, which is kind of a new departure for Belgian cafes. It's usually, you know, bottled beer is the way to go. But they have a connection with the Cantillon Brewery where they put a bunch of the Cantillon stuff on tap there at the Moda Lambic.
Mm.
Wow. And one more place, Wendy? One more cultural attraction we should
Cantillon. Well, then I guess I want you to go to Wallonia as well so that you can stop in and visit the DuPont Brewery, which is sort of the Belgian Brigadoon. It's just a beautiful farmstead brewery, and there's a little restaurant cafe across the street. And then just 10 kilometers, there's actually a 10K race between the DuPont Brewery and Dubuisson, which is the maker of Scaldis. And Scaldis has their Troll Cafe. And just to see the countryside of Wallonia is beautiful.
And Scaldis is called Bush over there, isn't that
mm-hmm.
right?
It is, because Dubuisson is the French for bush.
Right. And I got to say that the DuPont Brewery is definitely a destination. They have a cheese shop, and they make bread, and it's some of the best stuff. And back before terrorist crap was going on, I used to smuggle back wheels of their cheese and their bread back to the States because it was just some of the best cheese I've ever had.
Yeah, that's Olivier's wife is the cheesemaker. Yeah. She's a microbiologist. Try the Mimolette with the Hop Writer.
It's great. We're going to have some Mimolette. We'll take a short break here on Beer Sessions Radio.
Call my name out your window when I'm leaving. I won't even turn my head. Don't send your kin folks to give me no talking. I'll be gone, like I said. You'd say the same old thing that you've been saying all along. Lay there in your bed and keep your mouth shut till I'm gone. Don't give me that old familiar cry and cuss and moan. Understand, you're a man, I'm tired of your bad mouthing. Understand, you're a man.
Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43. My co-host tonight, Ray Dieter. We got some great guests. We got Tony Forder from Ale Street News, Wendy Littlefield from Van Berg and Wolf. So we're talking about the best places in Belgium to visit and some cultural references and the beers that go with them. Wendy and Tony, take it away.
Well, we're talking, how about Flanders?
Oh, let's see. Well, go to Ghent as a city. Which is, it's a university town. A lot of people think that they should go to Bruges because it's a canal city, but Ghent is a canal city that has more urban life. It's more real, I think.
But they never made a movie there, like In Bruges. I don't know if anyone's seen that.
No.
Classic.
See, I love Antwerp.
Yeah.
Antwerp, I think, is one of the most underrated cities in Europe. It's so hip and sophisticated.
It's so much fun. They've got all these fashion shops. There's so much going on there. It's by the river.
The design scene. Yeah, absolutely.
And there's great beer bars. It's one of the great beer bars in the world. I mean, Dirk's place. What's it called?
It's called The Culminator.
The Culminator, yeah. One of the great beer bars in the universe. Yeah. And I mean, it's very inspiring to me. We first opened up and I went over there and I was just completely amazed by the way he curates his beer. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that struck us when we first lived in Belgium. We would go to a friend's house for dinner and then he'd say, what would you like to drink? And you'd say, you know, Duvel or whatever he said. And they said, well, what year? Because people would have deep base, you know, they have cave with cases of beers from different years, and these were just like ordinary mortals.
You know, it always amazed me. I would go into Antwerp back in the days of the 24 Hours of Beer Festival, which was in Antwerp for a number of years. And so we had people from around the world that came to this town to go to these beer festivals. And then everybody wanted to go to the Culminator because Michael Jackson wrote so much about it and everybody knew about it. So on the Friday before the Saturday when the festival started, the place was a madhouse. Like everybody in the beer universe was there online trying to get in. And Dirk and his wife would not hire a single person to help wash glasses, get beer, or anything. It was just him and his wife, and maybe like their daughter or something. Three people, and the place was completely mobbed, and they did not lift a finger to move to make anything faster. It's like, you got there, you waited, they went back, and they found it, and they poured it properly.
And they never smiled. Dirk never smiles.
Ever. But he's actually a really lovely guy. But you know, he got the right glassware, and if the right glassware wasn't clean, they went and cleaned it for you. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, there's like 50, 60, 100 people outside waiting in the rain to get inside the place to try a beer. Always but amazed me.
Two laws in Belgium when we lived there. If your beer was brought to the table and the bottle had been opened, you could send it back. And if the beer was served not in its proper glass, you could send it back.
I do have to put in a vote for Bruges there. Because they have one of Belgium's other great bars, the Birchy Bruges, the Little Bruges Bear, which is by Daisy, who does a fantastic job and has a great selection and just a really friendly place.
You know, when you're talking about Brussels, too, I wanted to make sure that people knew to try Cantillon, and there's a new brewery open that I'm looking forward to seeing called the Seine Brewery, which is the first brewery to open in Brussels in more than a century.
Oh, De La Seine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Lambic.
Yeah.
As well.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing great stuff. That's
you know, we've had De La Seine. Towers Bulba.
Towers Bulba, right.
Mm-hmm. Shelton Brothers, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is fascinating for me because I've never been to Belgium. Another guest here
Jimmy
tonight.
Jimmy will be there until the end of April.
Will Stevens from beermanias.com is there also. And I get a feeling, you know, you've never been to Belgium. I've never been to Belgium. What would you want to know about Belgium as someone who's never been there? You've got to focus on American beers, I think. A lot of us, I think in New York too, like definitely American beer has kind of like come a long way in the last few years. And I don't think as many people know about Belgium as we think in Belgian beers. And what do you think, Will? You seem to be probably the resource for beers now with beermenus.com.
One question I would have for the people who are more knowledgeable about Belgium is, why is bottled beer so much more popular in Belgium than the U.S., where draft beer is pretty popular?
You know, that's an interesting question. I think the reason for that is that the breweries are so small. They just do bottling. They haven't got the capacity to actually put things in kegs. It's really hard. And also, managing the cleaning of barrels and the cooperage is very difficult because then you have to ship it out to the pubs and it has to come back, and it's a huge investment to have barrels of beer. So what I think what happens is, and I know this actually for a fact from my friends who are in the importing business, the importers actually provide a lot of the cooperage to bring the beer to the States, whereas you can get, like, for example, Duvel, you can get draft a version of Duvel here in the States now. I don't think that beer's available in Belgium.
Well, Duvel Green, actually.
Right. Just at the brewery.
Duvel Green. No, yeah. This is, I can tell you that when we began importing Duvel in 1982, the market in the United States for Belgian beer was virtually non-existent. There was Mannequin Brussels, and Charles Finkel of Merchant Devin was working on Lindemans. But it was a virgin territory. So Don went to the general manager at Mortgat and said, can I bring Duvel to America? And he said he was inclined to Don and said, yeah, I'll let you do it, but you know, Duvel is already coming to America. but it was only Duval Green, and it was only to Texas. And Don said, no, I don't want that, because that was a supermarket, like, granny beer.
Right.
He wanted the real bottle-conditioned Duval, and there was a real concern at the time that if it got shipped, that the climate was much more extreme in the United States, that the yeast would come back to life, that the bottles would explode, that they would have lawsuits, et cetera. So Duval Green...
Texas has crazy laws about alcohol content in beer. They have different names. They have malt liquor and versus beer versus...
Oh, we paddled a lot of that. Yeah. Didn't you have that in the early days?
Just to mention, I think the other good reason that Belgian beer has been so predominant in the bottle is because they are the kings of bottle re-fermentation in the bottle, and that is really their history of that's what they do. They re-ferment in the bottle, which is, why it's been traditionally in the bottle. But I think they're adapting to the American market because people are more attuned to draft beer.
Right. Well, I think a lot of the importers are actually facilitating the draft product, whereas you can't get a lot of that draft product actually in Belgium because the
except in the immediate neighborhood of the brewery. In the old days, they would, by draft horse, take it to the cafes that they owned, and then otherwise it was by bottle. Mm-hmm.
There's another myth, I don't know if it's a myth, but there's the story of Belgian beer that I don't know the answer to. I had heard that in the times of Prohibition, gin was banned in Belgium, but beer wasn't. And that's why they started making stronger beers. Is that true?
I've never heard of Prohibition ever happening in Belgium, or believe it could be the case.
I don't know about that.
I don't know. I'd heard there was a European, in Belgium, their version of Prohibition was gin was banned. They started making stronger beers.
Genever's with a half. I mean,
is a half strength gin, which is delicious.
It's with juniper berries or herbs. I've never heard of Prohibition in Belgium, so I don't believe that one.
I don't know. That doesn't make any sense to me at all.
I think also, remember.
you made that up, Jimmy.
Remember Michael Jackson's definition of places that tended to become great brewing cultures, that they were where grain belts and grape belts met. So Belgium qualifies there. It's a Latin temperament country that is in a place that's too cold to grow grapes, but they appreciate wine. And so all of the creativity that would have gone into winemaking, they channeled into beer. That's why I think they have strong beer.
I would agree with that. I think it goes to the bottle again, too, with the cork bottle. They treat it more like wine, and they brew it more to the wine strength. So
yeah, and also, I mean, northern France... The part of France that borders onto Belgium also has a great brewing culture there
as
well.
French Flanders.
Mm-hmm. Correct. And so that whole area has been a traditional brewing bastion for years and years and years and years. Mm-hmm. This whole prohibition in Belgium, though, I'm going to look into that.
Yeah, I think that's one thing we don't... I think there's a little bit of history that we don't all know about. I'd like to know more, too. I mean, we've all heard about the history of German beer and the Reinheitsgebot law. We know about that, and that's pretty straightforward. And we kind of know about American beer now. And we know a little about English beer.
Well, I'm from England originally. And the reason that English beer is brewed to session strength, really, was because of taxes. They were taxed on the strength of the beer.
That's right, yeah. So the stronger the beer is,
so
the more...
So was there a history of strong beers in Belgium, going back more than 100 years ago?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So in the monasteries, that was a tradition of having triples and quadruples?
Well, there was an interrupted history. The monasteries were making beer, but they were all shut down in the Napoleonic era. So continuous brewing of strong beer in Belgium? No, because it was stopped. But strong beers in Belgium, going back long into history, absolutely. The recipes, yes.
And so when you guys were there in 1980, this is the real question, kind of, is when you were back in 1982, which for some of us is history, but
Thank
it's really
you.
Not. I mean, I do find this. I feel like that in the world of food and beverage right now, people don't have a lot of history. You said it was hard to export. Tell me more about the market. I mean, it's so complicated. Just thinking about it now, it's like, gosh, we've got craft beer. We've got, all these scenes in America. And I still think that there's so much about Belgian beer that I don't know anything. And even though I've been drinking it for 15 years, I mean, I've heard more about it tonight than I ever have in my life.
Okay, well, the two things. I'll talk about the scene in Belgium and then what it was like to bring beer to the States. But in a nutshell, in Belgium at the time, it was a riotously creative and still is very, very creative culture. And every city had its own style of beer and prided itself on not having beer that was anything like its neighbor. So you would have, you know, the brown beers, the sour red beers of Flanders, different kinds of lambics. You would have wheat beers, saison, and then in the Flemish part, saison, on and on and on. It was just a tremendous, intense beer culture, also very related to food culture. Because it's a dirty little secret that Belgium has more Michelin-starred restaurants per capita than France.
The food is amazing in Belgium.
Yeah, the standard is very high, and Belgians spend more money per capita on art and food than any other nation in Europe, and they're wealthy people. So it was just a spectacular place to be as a young person. We had grown up in the States. We moved to Belgium. It was one of those aha moments when you go to a place and you see something that isn't valued in your own society at all being celebrated as something really great in another culture. Then you say, well, something's wrong. There must be. People would love this in America if they only could have it. Because when I was in college, I didn't even consider drinking beer. There wasn't anything interesting to drink. So that's what was the motivation to begin importing. Also, it would give us an excuse to go back and visit our friends in Belgium. Truly, that's what started it. Then we came to New York, where we lived, and we began to try to sell the beer. The first two places that we went, I told you, was Dina DeLuca, and that was Don's first sale. And the second was Hercules Grocery.
Oh, Hercules.
Yay,
oh,
Hercules.
Sixth Avenue.
I hope I can bring him a tape of this. But there, if you went to a restaurant, the wine buyer, sommelier, no interest in beer. In fact, they saw beer as a threat. If somebody ordered a beer instead of ordering wine, it was a less profitable meal for them. So it was a hugely uphill battle. And the way that we got around it is we went to chefs. And we brought the beer to chefs to sample, to cook with, and to drink after a night of cooking themselves, and they loved the beer. So they were the people who among themselves said, wow, this is really amazing stuff. You know, if you cook with lambic, it doesn't have this bittering, and on and on. So they spread the word for
when
us.
When was this, Wendy? What year?
1982. 82, when we started.
Okay.
When did you start DBA?
1994.
Yeah, so you guys were around the same time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we started pretty much the same time, mm-hmm. You know, yep. Early 90s.
I remember. Didn't we work together, Tony, on the Brooklyn Brewers Festival?
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, the Brooklyn.
I think that's the first
Brooklyn
time we
Fest
met.
Under mm-hmm. the Brooklyn Bridge. There, right?
That was great.
Yeah, a couple of editions of that, and yeah, it was a great festival. Unfortunately, the state shut it down. State property. They didn't, you know, want to support it.
I met Michael Jackson for the first time at that festival. He was signing books.
And Michael was a big influence on Don. And it was Michael who led Don to Saison DuPont, which was the time the DuPont Brewery was making the last Saison in Belgium, and they were considering ceasing production of it. There wasn't enough interest. Moinette always has been, in recent times, their most successful beer.
I really wonder what would have happened with Belgian beer if it hadn't been for Michael Jackson. Like, how long would it have taken to people to discover it? Because he was the one that really shined the light on Belgian beer. I think that was why Charles Finkel, you know,
had a huge influence. Though Don and Charles would tease Michael and say, it's fine for you to explain it, but somebody has to sell it. So all of the logistics of importing it and taking care of it and dealing with distributors who didn't pay their bills was the less glorious part of the enterprise.
Well, you guys have definitely done a great job, and it's almost your 30th anniversary. We'll take a short break. We'll be back with an author, Madeline Sherb, who's got a great book about Trappist breweries.
I rode my bicycle past your window last night.
Beer business, and now we're going back.
All right, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We've got some special guests tonight. We're going to give a little message, first of all. Thank you to GreatBrewers.com. Thank you to Good Beer Seal. And thank you to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is brings you over 20 shows each week featuring some of the most innovative voices in sustainable culture today. From cooking issues with Dave Arnold to We Dig Plants to Beer Sessions Radio, Heritage Radio Network shows are made possible by our generous sponsors and from listeners like you. So check out heritageradionetwork.com and you can donate if you like this show. We got a special guest calling in, Madeline Sherb. She's got a great book about A Taste of Heaven, about Trappist monasteries. Madeline, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for inviting me on.
We've got some friends here. We've got Tony Forder from Ale Street News, Wendy Littlefield from Van Bergen DeWolf.
Hi, Madeline.
Ray Dieter from DBA here.
Hi, everyone.
Hey, how you doing?
So, how long did you work on this book, Madeline?
The book took me about 6 years from start to finish. From the time I came up with the idea for the book to the time it was published took about 6 years.
And what was your favorite part? Did you get to visit all the monasteries?
Almost all of the monasteries that I write about in the book, I did do a retreat at. A retreat you can do for either 3 days or 5 days, typically. And so most of the monasteries I write about, including the Trappist beer monasteries, I did actually visit. There are so many monasteries making food and drink that I wasn't able to include them all. And in fact, in France alone, there's more than 500 monasteries making things like candy and, you know. So I just couldn't visit them all. And it still took 6 years.
We're talking about monasteries that make candy? So this, your book isn't just about beer. It's a guide to food and drink made by monks and nuns.
That's
a fascinating topic. It really is.
And I love the fact that you're focusing also on these communities being self-sufficient, because that's something we all need to think a little bit more about.
And I'm so glad you point that out, because, you know, people are tossing around the word organic all the time. And I like to say that the monks and nuns were living an organic lifestyle long before it became trendy, because they grew all their own food. They all started out as farmers, and they were making things like beer and cheese and bread, and they would serve it to pilgrims usually. So it's an old, old, old tradition.
They really should have green habits, I think. Well, maybe they do.
I haven't seen any green ones yet. You know, if you go to church throughout the year, you will see green at some point in the year.
Hey, Madeline, so what's the most bizarre thing that these nuns and monks produce that you saw?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Most of them are vegetarian. But there's a monastery in France that makes kind of things like goose liver pâtés and, you know, all that really heavy French meat product stuff. Mm. And when I was traveling around to the abbeys, I went to some in France, and they would just serve slabs of this. I'm not a big meat eater, but just slab after slab of this stuff would come out. And so some of the monasteries actually make it, too.
And actually, that kind of stuff goes great with beer.
It does.
What, you know, what's
it's
also very interesting is what you wrote about is some of these monasteries and food products are made here in the States.
Yes, about half of the monasteries in the book are in the United States. I started in the U.S. because it was, you know, it was more accessible.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have any monasteries that make beer here yet, but, you know.
Well, not yet. If I understand correctly, maybe you guys know the answer better than I do. There's a monastery in New Mexico that kind of experimented with it.
Okay.
And then gave it up. I keep hoping that there are some nuns who are going to get into the beer-making business.
Especially with the tradition of women as brewers. Have you had the cheesecake from Newskeet?
I love it.
Yeah, that's great.
From where?
It's the best cheesecake on earth.
The nuns of Newskeet Monastery make cheesecake.
And where is that monastery?
It's in New York.
Really?
Upstate New York. They're famous for raising German shepherds. So the monks raise and train German shepherds, and the nuns make cheesecake. The monks also smoke meats and make smoked cheese, and they're just less well known for their food stuff, but it's all delicious.
Madeline, you're a trip, and we love you. I'm going to ask you a couple questions to bring it back to beer, because we've been talking about Belgium. Tell us, why is this order called Trappist? That's
a really good question. Yeah, and you know what? Not all of the monasteries are Trappist monasteries. Trappist comes from the Abbey of La Trappe in France, T-R-A-P-P-E. That's how they get their name, Trappist. It's a nickname. It's actually the Order of Cistercians of the Strict Observance. That's the actual official name of the order of monks and nuns. And you can see why everybody calls them Trappist, because it's just easier. So the Cistercians of the Strict Observance are a reform of the Order of Cistercians, who were a reform of the Benedictines. So it kind of all started out in the 6th century with St. Benedict, who sat down and he wrote a rule that they're still living by to this day.
This sounds like something that Dan Brown might have wrote about.
Madeline, do you like beer yourself? Do you like beer?
Oh my gosh, the first Trappist beer I had was a revelation to me. It was like one of these transcendental moments, because it was actually Chimay. In fact, that's how I met Sam Merritt. I met Sam because I went to a Chimay tasting dinner in Tribeca, and I got to sit at the beer table with Sam and his folks. And I had Chimay beer, which was my first really higher quality beer that I'd ever had in my life. I'm from Wisconsin. And, you know, in Wisconsin, I drank a lot of beer in college, but it wasn't good beer. It was just beer. So that beer just changed it completely redefined beer for me. And I haven't looked back. I've never again had the kind of beer I had in college.
Madeline, one more question. One of the coolest moments in your book is you said there's a recipe where Charlie Trotter cooked with Trappist beers. How did you approach Charlie Trotter? You know, are you friends with him? Are you interested in cooking with beer?
You know, it's funny. I'm a humble cook, so I decided, well, you know, if I want to include recipes, the recipes are there to encourage people to buy these products from the monasteries to help support their way of life, because they do rely on the income from these products to support the monastery. Also, income from the guest houses, so I highly recommend that people go to these places on retreat. You don't have to be Catholic. So Charlie Trotter was one of the chefs who I approached, and I just approached him through his publicist. They were great. I mean, he was one of the first to respond. He created a recipe specifically for my book, and it uses beer and miso and something called beef cheeks. So if you want to try that, it's one of the higher-end recipes in the book. But one of my favorite recipes is very simple. It's caramelized bananas with a Trappist. It's a Trappist, I think it's a Westmalle beer in that recipe. It is absolutely divine.
Sounds good to me.
Wow. Try it.
And if we're traveling to Belgium, we're going to stick it to Belgium here. Traveling to Belgium, which Trappist monastery should we definitely visit? If we could only pick one.
Oh, boy. I would probably say Orval.
Orval.
But that's like asking someone to choose their favorite child. That's really unfair.
Did you ever see the tea bags at Orval? Would they put hops in bags that are size of men?
Yes.
They have tea baggers out there, too?
No, the hops are these man-sized tea bags.
Madeline, thanks for joining us. We're going to keep talking. All right?
Thanks.
Good luck. Your book's really great. And check out heavengourmet.com, Taste of Heaven. Well, we also have an email question from a really cool guy, Josh Heim in Indianapolis. Josh is a potter who's promised to send us beer mugs. And we're only going to say your website on air, Josh, if you do send them to us. until then, here's his question. I was explaining Omegang's Three Philosophers beer to a buddy of mine, and he asked if it was a barley wine. Would you mind explaining the difference between bottle-conditioned beer and a barley wine? Ray.
Oh, okay. Well, they're two different animals entirely. A barley wine doesn't have to be bottle-conditioned. Bottle-conditioned refers to the fact that the beer has been unfiltered and there's active yeast in the bottle. So that doesn't necessarily mean it's a barley wine. Many, many Belgian beers are that way. Saison DuPont is that way, bottle-conditioned. A lot of English beers, Fuller's ESB, is actually bottle-conditioned. A lot of American beers are. Sierra Nevada actually is a bottle-conditioned beer. And a barley wine, it's just a strong beer, filtered or not.
cool. Ben Woods here. He works with Van Bergen DeWolf in New York City. Great guy. What can you tell us a little bit more about bottle conditioning? Because you've got some really great beers that I've had in bottle. I always think that the Cesse de Pont is different than in bottle than in draft. Can you explain that to me?
I think Ray pretty much hit the nail on the head with that one. I mean, it basically, the yeast is still active. I feel like in draft format, it sort of maybe loses a little bit of effervescence, whereas with the bottle, you get that pop. It's fully carbonated, and, you know, typically when you order a bottle in a restaurant, you might, if they know what they're doing, they'll pour out your glass, and they'll leave the bottom inch or so, unless you request that you want the yeast.
Ray, you've done some cool nights where you've done the same beer in bottle versus draft for your liquids of interest.
Absolutely, yeah. We've contrasted them, and it's not that one is better than the other, but they're certainly different animals. And Saison DuPont, I gotta say, I think it's much better in the bottle. It just is. Because when you do pop that cork, what happens is you're introducing or reintroducing oxygen, and that creates a second fermentation in the bottle, and that's what gives it that effervescence, that peppery, wonderful pinpoint kind of carbonation that just is so lively and wonderful on your tongue. One of the great beers in the universe. This is definitely my desert island beer, Saison DuPont.
Hey,
no question.
I it's hard to say that you have a favorite child, but I think that is the most spectacularly delicious, handmade, rustic, versatile, fantastic, quenching, great beer.
You know, I got into an argument with Garrett Oliver from the Brooklyn Brewery a long time ago when we first opened up DBA. He was telling me that Saison DuPont was his favorite beer in the world, and I just wanted to argue with him. I just wanted to say, no, it's not. There's better beers out there. And I tasted it, and I was like, yeah, it really is really good. But I can't agree with him. I can't, like, it's like, no, I'm Ray Dieter, you're Garrett Oliver. We have to have a different opinion about things. But he was totally right.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you're in town, Wendy, because I haven't had Saison DuPont in a while, and this weekend I've had the Monat.
I'm doing my job.
I've had Biofuret, the Avril.
And wait till you taste Posca Rustica.
Ooh.
That's a spice beer from DuPont that's coming in the spring, and we're bringing in Foray Blanche.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
I'm looking forward to that.
Before we sign off, you brought an aged lambic.
I did indeed.
Can we taste that on air and just tell everybody what that is, because it seems really rare and unusual?
It certainly is. I'm going to give Ben the...
Pouring that, I thought I'd just jump on the Saison situation there. The Saison DuPont still is the standard, I think, of Saisons. But it's amazing how, and this is an example of how American brewers have adapted a lot of Belgian styles. There's, you know, a lot of Belgian styles being brewed in the States now, and American brewers have really taken the Saison thing in a lot of different directions. So there's some great domestic Saisons to try.
Kelso's making a great Saison when they do it the seasonal. Kelly Taylor over at Kelso makes a great Saison. I've liked his. And also Southampton. Those guys are making a great Saison, too.
There's things like Black Saison, Double Saison.
And a historical footnote, when we started bringing in Saison DuPont, not only was it the only Saison in Belgium, but there obviously was no Saison interpretation in the United States yet. Last year, the most imitated style of beer from any country by American microbrewers was the Saison.
Huh.
And, it speaks to the creativity and energy of American brewers. So there are lots of good ones out there. And I think, as Ray does, to do comparative tastings is a wonderful way to figure out which one you really like.
I prefer comparative as opposed to competitive. Like, right. I know a lot of places do, like, you know, they number their beers and, you know, the winner is this and the winner is that. But I don't like doing that. I think that there's value in everything.
Yes,
you know,
it's not supposed to be a smackdown.
I agree.
Let's talk through this beer, because we don't do that too often on the air. This is a great beer, 10-year-old lambic.
Whoa, that nose is amazing.
The nose.
It smells like salad dressing.
And has this beer changed in 10 years?
No, so what happened is this beer was already 3 years old when it was bottled, and then it was bottled 7 years ago. We first started drinking it when it was still in the cask, and begged, can we bring it in, can we bring it in, can we bring it in, to Carl, who was the brewer at Whitcap, but also the blender at DeKalb. And he said, yes, you can. But then he Don would send him an order and he didn't ship it. So finally we have it. And I would say, yes, it tastes as it tasted when we had it.
There's a sweetness to it that's kind of unexpected. What is that from the blending?
I don't know how to explain it. It's just the art that he has of going from cask to cask. There are cidery notes. There's almost sometimes a hint of almost of cherry underneath it. It has this vanilla aroma. It's almost still, which is the thing that is really people need instruction on. This is an old lambic. It's meant to be flat. It's not meant to be as sparkling as champagne.
Well, there's still a bit of carbonation there. There's still a bit of conditioning in there.
But very soft. And
very
it's
soft.
Very woody as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think?
That's amazing. I don't know if all the listeners really know. We're talking about the Old Goose, which is, this spontaneously fermented beer that the lambic, maybe you know that, and the Goose is the blended version where they leave it in different barrels and then blend different years. And yeah, this is amazing. It's got, I mean, the first time I tried this style beer back in the 90s, people were saying descriptors like wet horse blanket. I'm like, wow, that's really great.
Yeah. What does that mean?
But it's true. It's got these barnyard, it's an acquired taste.
But this is more buttery, I think, than horse blankety. Mm-hmm.
And when they blend
buttery horse blanket.
That's why I brought the caramel. I thought we should all taste a little bit of the caramel
that's
with it.
That's what's in front of me right here. These are caramels.
And Wendy, you also brought some other food. You had planned some beer and food pairings. Why don't you talk us through it before we sign off?
Well, at this point, it's going to really be lost on the listeners, but there's an aged cheese, a mimolette, which is a French, very dry, sort of sharp, cheddary, buttery cheese. And that's just great with beer in general. And, you know, it helps to relax the taste buds in between beers. There's a banana and beer nut muffin, because Ben and I were at Beer Craft, and they made these muffins, and I thought a banana nut muffin would be really good with Scaldus.
And beer nuts are in it, too?
There are nuts in it, yeah.
No, but not beer nuts.
No. Oh, okay. It has almonds and beer and bacon.
Bacon.
Yeah. Wow.
Everything's better with bacon.
And then this is an ice cream sandwich that's made with stout and dulce de leche ice cream. What else?
What was the pairing for that?
And caramel.
For the ice cream sandwich.
I don't know. We can try. I thought it should be comparative,
let's
not
mix
competitive.
And match.
Yeah.
We're going to hang out here at Roberta's out in Bushwick. We're going to try some of Wendy Littlefield's beer and food pairings. We're going to eat some of great food out here. This has been a really cool show. We didn't get a chance too much to talk to Will Stevens from Beer Menus. Tony Forder, we'll definitely have you back. Please check him out, Ale Street News, the Belgian Zyphos
tour. Right. We do still have room on our tour to Belgium. It leaves February 28th for a week. AleStreetNewsOnline.com.
And Ben Wood and Wendy Littlefield from Van Bergen DeWolf will be at Jimmy's number 43 tonight. There's a $10 tasting of some of their portfolio, some really good stuff. Ray and I, we're going to sign off. Thanks to greatbrewers.com. Thanks to our producer, Bree, and Jack Inslee. And Jimmy Carboni and Ray Dieter. We'll see you next week on Beer Sessions Radio.
In some of my songs, I have casually mentioned the fact that